Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In this world of liars and lies, in this world of bullets and bombs, in this world where all we have seem able to do is to kill one another, it's nice on occasion to turn to Yahweh and listen to what he has to say. He is opposed to human institutions. As a matter of fact, he is so disgusted by man's military, political, patriotic, economic, and media sources that at every opportunity, he not only assails them, telling us why he views them as hypocritical and counterproductive, but he tells us if we wish to engage in a relationship with him, as the relationship existed in the Garden of Eden, we must separate ourselves from our country, from politics and patriotism, from military adventurism, from all of the corrupt economic schemes, especially from religion. He's not allowing that stuff into his home. It's his home. It's his call. He says, I'm going to give you free will. You can do whatever you doggone want to do. That's your choice. I gave you free will. If you want to be murderous, be murderous. If you want to be a hawk and think that the answer to everything is engaging in another war, make John McCain your exemplar. If you think that lies are always the best answer, then vote for Barack Hussein Obama. You know, if that's what you want, have at it. But he says, you're not dragging that rubbish into my home. My home for all eternity is going to be filled with people who are opposed to that because I'm opposed to it. And that's why the Garden of Eden was walled. It kept out the death and destruction, the sorrow that was in the world surrounding it. And that's why Yisrael is a metaphor for living with God, being protected by him. That's why Sukkah serves as that same metaphor of camping out with God, being protected by him, sheltered, kept away, set apart from all of these human institutions that are so destructive, deceitful, deadly, and damning. When God tells a story, it's interesting that he communicates on many levels simultaneously. For example, in the story with Eden, the primary symbolism of the story of Eden, even though it was a real place, is that in a covenant relationship, God's goal, his whole sole purpose for the universe, the first thing that he did after he conceived the universe and life, was to create a protective, nurturing, joyful environment to enjoy a relationship with Adam. That's what he did. That's the first thing he did. It was his first priority. And seeing the nature of that relationship should tell us as to what God is like, what he wants, and what opportunity we have in terms of engaging in a relationship with him and what the consequence of that relationship will be over the long time. It is also a physical place. Eden was actually a place on this planet, and we're going to examine where it was. Because one of the things about God is that even though every story he tells has profound symbolism, every story he tells is also grounded in reality. The creation account, every single day is representative of his plan of salvation and what he's going to do and how he's going to do it and when he's going to do it. But it's also a real story grounded in truth in terms of when and how and why he created the universe. So now as we turn to Eden and locating the place, now that we know its purpose, he said a river flowed out from Eden with the water of the protective enclosure, and from there it separated, becoming four headwater sources. The name of the first is the Pishon. It winds its way through all of the region of Hayela, where relationally there is gold. This is from Bereshith, which means in the beginning, corrupted to Genesis 2, 10 and 11. Let's begin to talk about this. First of all, a river flowed out, extended and descended from Eden. That means that it is the headwaters, not the mouth. There's a bunch of people that want to place Eden at the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates River. No, rivers flow out of their headwaters. A river flowed out from Eden. That would be the headwaters of the river. Water is the symbol for purification. It's also the symbol of life. Yahweh makes it very clear that when he uses water, he's speaking of water as a metaphor. Now, it's a real tangible thing. A river did flow out of this. In fact, we're going to find the headwaters of four rivers because he spoke of four. But water, when it's used, is a symbol for two things. The inception of life. We are born in water. You know, when we come into this world, our mother's water breaks. We are embryos and we become literally born, gushing forth from water. Water was the source of life. It's where God told us that he conceived life. It was out of waters that the first life emerged. And we know that our very being is mostly water. Also, water is the universal solvent. It is unique properties that cause it to be a wonderful source of cleansing. It conveys both of those two things. And so this was a clean, protective place where life was being celebrated. That's why the waters flowed out. It was a Eden, a place of great joy, ultimate pleasure, extreme satisfaction. We actually transliterated the Hebrew word correctly as Eden. Of the protective enclosure. It is a gar. Here it didn't say Gar Eden or even Eden Gar, but instead Eden La Saka Gar. So that we would focus on each of the terms. Eden, meaning this place that God created. His first priority was great joy, delight, pleasure, extreme satisfaction, favorable conditions that lead to great gladness. Focus on that. That was God's purpose in his relationship with humankind, which means he doesn't want to be worshipped. He wants to celebrate our relationship. He wants to have fun. The next word was law, which means to approach. That is how we approach God, is how God approaches us. And he speaks of water not with the normal Hebrew mem or meyam, which would be plural for mem, which is the primary Hebrew word for water, but saka, that which quenches thirst. He wants to quench our thirst for life, for happiness, for joy, for fulfillment. He next uses the term God, a word that is changed often to garden, and it's nothing wrong with calling it a garden, but gar is primarily a protective enclosure that is suitable for life. That's a far more descriptive phrase. Now, from there, it says, it's separated. So this river that flowed out of the garden became four. One became four. Now, why is four meaningful? When you look at Yah's plan, you see that there are certain numbers that are repeated over and over and over again for a pattern. One, for example, God is one. There is no such thing as a Trinity. God is one. Man was created on the sixth day. He is a carbon-based life form. Carbon has the molecular weight of six. Man, six, plus one, God, equals God's idea of Eden. Great joy, delight, pleasure. That's his equation. Six plus one equals seven. Everything that God says to us that's important is all based on six plus one equals seven. There are six steps we take with to God, beginning at the doorway named Passover, leading us to his home, Sukkah, shelters. There are 6 days a week that we can do our own thing, working however we see fit. On the seventh, God asked us to spend it with him. Everything is the pattern of six plus one equals seven with God. Now, what is, so we know what one is, we know what six is, we know what seven represents. What about four? It's the other number that means something here. Araba. It means square, four-sided. It also means to stretch out, rest, and relax. Well, four is always presented as the time of testing. You're going to, you know, we find that it rained for 40 days and 40 nights during the flood of Noah. We will find that the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. We find that Yahusha was tested himself in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. It's always presented as the number. There's no other number ever used for a period of of trial, for testing, for examination, ever. Always 40. A multiple of 4. The reason that's important, if you look at God's primary symbols, the Mikre, the 6 plus 1 steps that lead to him on the 7th of those steps, and you look at the 6 plus 1 days of creation, where 6 days God worked to create the universe and the 7th that he rested. If you look at man being comprised of our history in the creation account being laid out on those 7 days, with the 7th day being the Shabbat, so a 1,000-year celebration of life, celebrating the Shabbat in the conditions of Sukkah, shelters, the 7th called-out assembly, then what you can do quite easily is to take the Yobel years that God said are set apart for the purpose of freeing captives, so that all slaves are freed, and for the forgiveness of all debts, so there are no more ongoing obligations, that the Yobel years are 7 times 7 plus 1 every 50 years. What's 40 times 50, my friends? It's 2,000. So if you look at Adam and Chawa leaving the garden, and the date of their departure, which is 3,000 and just shy of 3,000, just shy of 4,000 years ago, 3,000 some 968 years ago. What you find is that if you go 20 Yobel from that time, you get to the point where Abraham and Yahweh are meeting on Mount Moriah, where Yahweh is providing the sacrificial lamb to save the firstborn child, Laughter, named after Eden, right there on Mount Moriah. Multiply 40 times 50 from that date, because that occurred in 1968 BCE, 2,000 years, 40 Yobel, from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted from the garden. What happens then, 40 Yobel later? What happened 2,000 years from 1968 BCE? Well, in 33 CE, Yahweh, in corporeal diminished form, fulfilled the first 4 Moed Mikre, the meetings that he had told us that he would fulfill, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah, right on time, just as he had promised. So what is 2,000 years, 40 Yobel from 33 CE? Perhaps 2033? Is that when the rest will be fulfilled? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about a river flowed out from Eden, from the place of great joy, with the water of the protective enclosure. And from there, it separated, becoming 4. We just considered what 4 means, why 4 was used here, what we can learn from it. And it spoke of this being the headwaters of those 4 rivers. The headwaters is from Rosh. Rosh is the Hebrew word to mean head. It is depicted even in the original alphabet that was used to scribe this testimony in the Torah as depicting a head. It conveyed a lot of things. One of the head is in the top of the body, therefore this would be the head waters. It also shows the head, which is the source where we use our eyes to observe what's happening around us. We use our ears to listen to what is occurring. We can listen to God when we recite his word using our eyes and our ears, and then our brain, we can process this information. And so not only were we being told that Eden was the first priority, and that this protective and sheltered enclosure of great joy was what God cared about the most, but that we could use our eyes and our ears and our brain to understand what he is communicating. But most certainly, this is the headwaters of 4 rivers, not their mouth. The name of the first is the Pishon. It is from Push, meaning to spring up, to act proudly, and to scatter. It winds its way, it meanders, constantly changing course, through all of the region. This is Eretz. This is not the whole world, it's just the region. And Eretz is the area that was flooded, by the way, which is a region. It's amazing how English translators and Christians want to use Eretz in a duplicitous way. When God said that he flooded the Eretz, it was then the whole world, where here he's saying that it winds through, this river winds through the Eretz, But they, of course, would not change or translate this same word to whole world, because that would be stupid. Well, flooding the whole world was stupid. There was no chance that the whole world was flooded. God didn't say the whole world was flooded. He said that the Eretz was flooded. That is a region. And so it winds through all of the Eretz, the region of Hayalah. Hayalah is from Hul, which means to twist and to encircle, to bring fear, pain, and anguish. Where relationally, there is gold, Zahab, considerable wealth, money, and splendor. All right. Bar-Rashith, Genesis 25:18, speaking of Hayalah, Yahweh tells us that Ishmael, which is the father of today's Arab Muslims, settled from Hayalah to Shur, which is east of Egypt as one goes toward Assyria, in defiance of all of his relatives. Assyria was located between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is today northern Iraq and Iran. If you were to travel from Egypt to Assyria, you would pass through the southeastern part of Turkey near its borders with Syria, northern Arabia, Iraq, and Iran. That would be the area that you would pass through. But more on this later as we consider where this river wandered. It says, and the gold, the Zahab, the considerable wealth of that land, of that region and realm, the Delum Rezum, this is from Vedola, the translucent odoriferous amber gum from an Arabian tree, from Badal, to divide and separate, and the precious, the reddish onyx, lapis lazuli, and malachite, beryl stones, even rocks and gems, there are beautiful. They are tob, we're told, in Bar-Rashith 2:12. So we're giving quite a description. Now, do you think that Yahweh told us all this information about not only the region, which is Hayalah, which he later describes as if you were going between Egypt, because Egypt, remember, Ishmael's mother was Egyptian. And so he wants to, and the children of Israel were taken away from Egypt. Egypt was bad, a source of political and religious, military and economic might that was very corrupt, enslaving people. If you go from there towards Assyria, Assyria and Babylon are considered the embodiment of evil and throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And as you go through there, he's talking about all the things that you would find. Now, do you think that he provided all of this information because he's just an old God who just loves to ramble on, providing nonsense that makes no sense at all, that has no value, that you can't use in any possible way to ascertain anything important? Or do you think perhaps he gave us this information because he wants you to know where Eden is located? So that once you know where it is located, you can recognize what happened in the aftermath of the flood, where it occurred. You can see how man's civilizations emerged from there, how that which was good turned evil, and how that which is evil will once again become good in the last days. You know, this whole story with all of the details here that Yahweh has provided reminds me of what we have experienced in so many other ways with Christian ignorance. You know, Christians will tell you that no one knows the time or the hour because they take one statement that is improperly translated and improperly rendered in their so-called New Testament out of context. And they don't even realize that in the Greek it doesn't say that no one will ever know. It just says that you fellows right there, you're not aware of using the weakest form of to know in Greek, which is just to be cognizant of, not thinking through, just even having any idea at all. And they will ignore the fact that there are 10,000 clues that God provides about his timing. And that many of those clues are the most dominant communications that he provides. They won't even think about any of that. They'll just discard it all in one misrepresented statement. Let's not think. Let's not look at the evidence. Well, we wouldn't want to do that. And the same thing is true here. God provides all of the evidence so that we know where Eden is, so that we can understand where the flood occurred, and so that we can understand the march of humanity and the consequence of humanity and the evil nations and institutions that were born between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers with Assyria and with Babylon, and the consequence of man's political and religious and military institutions. And yet they would disregard it all and say, oh, it's just a story. Well, the reference to gold, great wealth, money, and splendor, as well as gemstones, could be a reference to mines which exist in this region. I think Yahweh was referring to the opulence of Nineveh, which was the capital of first Babylon, and later the principal city of the Assyrian Empire. Man's first known religious and political schemes were conceived and perpetuated there. It was the birthplace of the sun god religion practiced today as Roman Catholicism. It remains a region of considerable wealth, money, and splendor. It is what separates the masses from God. Now, Yahweh went on and said, the name of the second is the Gihon. It winds its way through the whole land of Cush. Cush, more commonly rendered just as with a C, it's actually spelled with a K, was the first son of Ham in addition to Mitzrayim, Put and Canaan. So biblical scholars want to put Cush, make it represent Ethiopia because its root means black. But what is today Ethiopia is often part was often part of Egypt at the time, and Egypt is called Mitzrayim in the Torah. And while there is plenty of scriptural evidence to connect Cush with ancient Egypt, that nation's genesis was still 1,000 years hence, meaning that Yahweh wasn't describing an emerging culture in northern Africa. Further, the Nile flows north from central Africa, not south from eastern Turkey. But here's a clue. Nimrod, the patriarch of the region of the king of Nineveh, which was in Assyria, today or then called Babylon, was a descendant of Cush and was known to have been a black man. So we might surmise that Cush, at least at this time, represents what is today northern Iran and Iraq. It was a region America has recently and foolishly unified under Shia Islam. It is the area which will one day serve as the headquarters of the All-Islamic Magog Federation, something the scriptural genealogies also confirm. As evidence of this theory, the Iranians call the 12,000-foot range, which towers above the modern city of Tabriz, the Kush-e-Dag, or Mountains of Cush. Located in the upper and the northwestern finger of Iran, near Lake Urmia, the Cush Range is fewer than 2,000 miles from the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, the next two rivers that will be on Yahweh's list. Also potentially telling is the association of Cush Black with the name of the world's first inland sea, the Black Sea, which, not so coincidentally, is adjacent to the headwaters of the next two rivers. Yahweh says, the name of the third river is the Tigris. It is from Hiddekel, from Hadar, to rapidly surround and to close in, to besiege, bringing impending doom, which travels east of Ashur, which is Assyria, named after the goddess Ashur, who became Ishtar and Easter over time. You know, one of the things I just want to point out here is that I have a lot of people that write me very condescending letters because the English word God is found in the books that I write, whether it be Yada Yah or Introduction to God or even Questioning Paul. I will use a God as a title because it's a reasonable translation of El and Elohim in the Hebrew text. And say, oh, but that's the name of a pagan god. No, it's not the name of a pagan god. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's a title, not a name. And Yahweh is God's one and only name. El is just one of Yahweh's titles. But here, they will say, you know, but you can't use the name of pagan gods. You're not to speak them. Well, I'm not using the name of a pagan god. God's name is not God. It's a title. But here, Yahweh uses Ashur. Asher, to speak of Assyria, is the name of the goddess, the country was named after the goddess Ashur. So, simply using the name of a pagan god or goddess can't be something that Yahweh was saying you can't do. What he's saying is that I don't want you to use the name of pagan gods or goddesses in a reverent way, you know, paying homage to them, lifting them up as if they were actually gods. Because God only has one name, Yahweh. But to speak of them from a just geographic point of view, or a historic point of view, or from a, you know, I'm going to warn you about this point of view, it's just fine. Anyway, it's which travels east of Asher. And the fourth river is the Euphrates, the Perat, known as the Great River. Hiddekel is the Akkadian, which is Akkadian is the ancient Assyrian and Babylonian language, pronunciation of what has become renamed the Tigris in Greek following Alexander's conquest. Likewise, the Perat or Great River was the Hebrew term for the waterway the Greeks renamed the Euphrates in the 3rd century BCE. Now, mind you, this was committed to writing 1400 BCE, and because of the conquest of Alexander the Great, the names now favor a Greek influence because of Alexander's conquest. But at the time this was written, they were known by their original names, which is what Yahweh has used. Both tributaries of the Tigris begin their 1,300-mile trek to the Persian Gulf in the mountains west and southwest of Lake Van in eastern Turkey, 200 miles due south of their easternmost shore of the Black Sea. So we're 200 miles, very close to the easternmost shore of the Black Sea, and in eastern Turkey, Lake Van. The east branch begins its journey to the sea 20 miles south of Lake Van, and the western source emerges 100 miles due west of Turkey's largest lake, which is Lake Van. Moving on to the Euphrates, its twin tributaries emerge 100 miles northwest and 50 miles due north of Lake Van. The latter, not far from the mountains of Ararat, which will play prominently in our story. From here, the waterway travels a great 1,700-mile arc west, east, south, and then southeast to the Persian Gulf. Walled in by volcanic mountains, Lake Van and its neighbor, Lake Urmia, 150 miles southeast of Lake Van, has no natural outlet and thus is saline, as are the Black and Caspian Seas. Although the Black Sea was not originally saline, it is now. The Lake Van is considered to be the largest and deepest lake in the Middle East. Satellite photos depict it as a royal blue oasis surrounded by inhospitable, rugged, and desolate terrain. Now, turning our attention to the Gishon, I have every confidence that it is the Aras, shown on some maps as the Araxes. This mighty river's tributaries emerge northeast of Lake Van. During the century-long Islamic invasion, which followed Muhammad's death in 632 CE, the river's name was changed from Gayun, marking the original moniker quite similar, or making the original moniker very similar to Gishon, Gayushun, to that found in Genesis. So the original name, prior to Muhammad's Muslims savaging the area, was Gayun, which is very similar to the Hebrew Gishon. The only real difference is, the only difference really, is the hard CH rather than what we are assuming was a softer H in the word prior to the Islamic invasion. Otherwise spelled identically. Today, the Eris, formerly the Gaishun, flows eastward from Turkey into the Caspian Sea. Ignoring the fact that God said that the headwaters of these four rivers, two of which are the Tigris and Euphrates, flowed from the same place and the same source, renowned religious scholars continue to postulate claims that the Pishon is the Ganges. Some say the Indus or the Nile. Others place Eden at the delta of the Tigris and Euphrates as if they don't understand the difference between the beginning and the end of a stream. I share this with you for two reasons. First, don't trust religious scholars. Second, the Garden of Eden is located very near the location of Noah's flood. They are essentially coterminous, the latter just east of the former. The mountains of Ararat are located 200 miles east by northeast of the headwaters of the Tigris and are within a stone's throw of the Euphrates beginnings. This area in eastern Turkey, between the Black and Caspian Seas, near the border of Iran and Armenia, under Lake Van, is where we would find Eden. Now we'll return to Shattering Myths for our last segment, continuing to develop this story so we know where God is talking about in addition to what he is talking about, because it provides the foundation and the perspective for understanding. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths, the last segment of our program today. We will return to discuss the utter stupidity of Syria and how nothing can be gained and so much can be lost by the American invasion in our program tomorrow. And we will continue our story of Yahweh's explanation of Eden and where it is located so that we have the proper perspective and understanding the events which followed. Now, identifying the Pishon, which is the fourth of these four rivers, is the only one that is really challenging. The other three, we know what the original name was of the Aras River, which is identical to the term that God chose. We know where it flows. And so all of the rivers, the great river, the Tigris and Euphrates, and the Gaishon are easy to identify. They all emerge very near Lake Van in the shadow of the Ararat Mountains. So identifying the Pishon is the only challenge. Having identified, now, it can't be too big of a challenge because he gave us four rivers that all flowed from a similar source. Now, this is a highly volcanic area, so over the last 6,000 years, a great deal has changed in the topography, but even with the volcanic rising of these mountains, like the Ararat Mountains, are all fairly new volcanoes in terms of Earth's genealogy. We know where to look for it because the other three are all emerged right around Lake Van. So as we look for the Pishon, symmetry would suggest that we would be wise to look for a river because we can notice that we have a river that flows southwest, that we have a river that flows southeast, and we now should be looking, and we know we have a rivers that flow all the way around. So what we're looking now for is a river that would flow north or northwest of Lake Van, because we also have one that flowed northeast. In this regard, I think the most likely candidate for the Pishon is the Red River, today known as the Kizil Irmak. The Red River is a good fence since Yahweh told us that it would be known for its red stones. Okay, Red River, red stones, that's a pretty good clue. Also, the original name of Turkey's longest river, the Fasinos, confirming that it was a worthy candidate for Pishon. The P, the H, and the N are the three, the SH. So you have a P versus a PH, an SH versus an S, and an N with just the US, which is a grammatical addition. So the Fason and the Pishon are extraordinarily similar. They carry the same traits of the same three letters, which is, by the way, how you identify almost everything from the ancient world to modern. You look at three-letter patterns, and the same three letters are the pattern that we find in Pishon and Fashin. Most all of the etymological tools connect the ancient names to their modern equivalents, as I have just shared, by comparing what is typically considered the consonant root before vocalization and conjugation. The Fasanius and the Pishon share the same PSN root. The Red River source is less than 100 miles west by northwest of Lake Van. Oh, perfect symmetry. Unlike the other three rivers, it flows west and then north before draining into the Black Sea. Neolithic civilizations along this river date back to 4000 BCE, with the Assyrian, the Phygian, and the Hittite colonies emerging around 1900 BCE. The control of this volcanic region passed to the Tubals, the Persians, and then the Greeks under Alexander, before falling to the Romans, the Byzantines, and the Seljuks, the Mongolian Muslims who invaded the Christian capital of Constantinople, forming the Ottoman Empire and Istanbul. It would be on the Red River shores that the Turks annihilated over 1 million Armenian Christians in a genocidal rage in the aftermath of World War I, literally turning the waters red. David Rold, who is a superb antiquity scholar, I think he is a very reasonable man, which is why he is considered a pariah in the ancient antiquities era, speculated that the Pishon is the Uzun. Its tributaries descend from the volcanic ridges of Lake Urmia, 200 miles southwest of Lake Van. And when we consider what he wrote in A Test of Time and in his other books, we'll have more food for fodder, more opportunity to understand what Yahweh is telling us and have the proper perspective for everything that he says happens next.